Libya, Yemen, Bahrain, Syria, Egypt, Tunisia, Israel, Palestine, Gaza. This feels like an unprecedented moment in the Middle East. What is happening, and what does it all mean for the people of that region, for the price of oil, for the clash between Islam and the West, and for the U.S. both abroad and at home? Around the beginning of the war in Iraq, I was channel surfing on a Sunday morning, and nestled among all the infomercials, I came upon a woman making a lot of sense about Iraq, the Middle East, U.S. foreign policy, and our role in the world. I was lucky enough at that time to tune in at the top of an hour. Interview between the late Tim Russert and today's guest, Robin Wright, five-time Pulitzer Prize nominee, and at that time, the chief diplomatic correspondent of the L.A. Times. At the end of the hour, I wished our nation's decision makers were asking her advice, and I committed to having her as my guest. She joined me in 2003, again in 2008, and today, though I know she's in the final stretch of a book deadline, Robin Wright will be my guest for the next hour. I believe Wright's experience and perspective is particularly valuable. Her last book, Dreams and Shadows, The Future in the Middle East, drew on 35 years of reporting through wars, revolutions, and uprisings, as well as the birth of new democracy movements and a new generation of activists in 24 countries. As she said of that book in 2008, my goal was to probe deep inside societies of the Middle East for the emerging ideas and players that are changing the political environment in ways that will unfold for decades to come. Robin Wright has reported from more than 140 countries on six continents for numerous news organizations, including the Sunday Times in London, CBS News, the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor, the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Atlantic Monthly, Foreign Policy, and the International Herald Tribune. She's covered 9 wars and several revolutions. She's won the Overseas Press Club Award for best reporting in any medium, requiring exceptional courage and initiative for her work during the Angolan War. Wright was one of the first journalists to write about the emergence of Mideast terrorism and Islamic extremism, which she has covered since the 1970s. Currently a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, she won the 1989 National Magazine Award for her reporting from Iran for The New Yorker. Her latest book is Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, and her next, the one she's in that deadline on, is Rock the Casbah, How Street Vendors, Sheikhs, Rappers, and Women Are Shattering the Old Order. Welcome again, Robin Wright.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you so much. As I said, I do know that you are in a crunch. I'd like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So you spent years, as I've just outlined, as a correspondent reporting in from more than 140 countries on six continents, as I mentioned. I believe you've been on the road less the last few years while working on a couple of books. Am I right? And if so, do you miss it?
No, I continue to go out quite often. What I usually do with a book is spend a year or two on the road, really doing intensive interviews, talking to a wide range of people, and then I kind of hide away for a few months while I write a book, and then I start going out again.
So this is, you're in a hideaway right now, but it hasn't been a long one.
No, that's correct.
Okay. You wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post in March 2008, which is over 3 years ago, Why I Have New Hope for the Mideast. And I want to read just a few quotes, because you've been investigating the seeds of reform in the Middle East for years, and now seemingly, suddenly, change is on the move. This is what you wrote. In the early 21st century, a budding culture of change is creatively challenging the status quo and the extremists. New public voices, daring publications, and noisy protests across 24 countries are giving shapes to a vigorous, if disjointed, search for alternatives to the autocratic regimes and imperious monarchies that have proved they're out of sync with their people. The issue in the Middle East, this is March 2008, is no longer whether to seek political change, it's how to make it happen. And then you wrote, 2 decades ago when I roamed the region, I sought out clandestine cells as the barometer of opposition. Now I look for computer nerds, the pajama Hadin or pajama warriors who wield computers instead of roadside bombs. They personify lesson one in the changing Middle East. The opposition is more open, ambitious, imaginative, and stubborn than ever, and the YouTube generation has become a whole new political class. Before getting into specifics of what's going on in one country or another, can you describe what's happening broadly, your take on this moment?
Oh, I think this is colossal change across the region. that has been long in the works reflects a lot of factors. One is the demographic reality of so many people who are under the age of 30. In some countries like Yemen, the median age is 18. 60% or over 65% actually are under their early 30s. In a place like Iran, in Egypt, they're in their mid-20s. And so you have this huge youth bulge at a time that they have access to information about the outside world through the Internet. The governments no longer control all access to media or all images of what's going on in the world. And so you have the dynamics have changed radically. And they've combined with the forces of change that have reshaped the world generally over the last quarter century and finally brought change to the last block of countries to hold out against the democratic tide. And while I was writing about this trend 3 years ago, there also is an awful lot to be concerned about because you've had autocratic rulers, men who are geriatrics, ruling their countries for decades. And that has not helped prepare people for these really historic transitions. You look at a place like Libya, where Muammar Gaddafi has been in power for 42 years and has been draconian in eliminating all avenues of alternative organization or mobilization, all access to civil society, the kinds of nascent organizations that help form political parties. So some of these transitions are going to be very rough as a result. There's a lot to celebrate in a place like Egypt, which is the heart and soul of the Arab world, accounts for one quarter of the population that's spread out in 22 countries. But there's still an awfully long way to go.
I went back and looked at Dreams and Shadows, and I remember you looked at the possibilities of reform country by country. And are you willing to take that approach right now, offering fairly brief assessments of current events country by country?
Sure.
Okay. So we're going to obviously talk about Libya, so I'm going to leave that aside. That one everyone is talking about. Let's start with Yemen. The U.S. clearly backed Saleh as part of our anti-terrorism efforts. Saleh says he's willing to step down in the fall on the one hand and warns of civil war if he's forced to do so now on the other. Your assessment, your advice.
Yemen is one of the trickiest countries. This is currently led by President Saleh, who's been in power since 1978.
Wow.
And so, again, you have another country where the transition is going to be very tough. It is a country that is deeply tribal, has ethnic differences, has sectarian divides. There is a rebellion in the north and a secessionist movement in the south. And this is also the country where Al-Qaeda's franchise, which is called Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, is the most active of all Osama bin Laden's offshoots. And so there's a lot to worry about in a country that has virtually no oil for export, which is the poorest of all the Arab countries. The per capita income is about $2,600 a year. And, again, it's a overpopulated, largely rural and poor population in which a lot of people also chew something called khat, which is a kind of narcotic. So there are a lot of problems in Yemen to worry about, and I suspect that Saudi Arabia, which borders it, is particularly nervous. Remember, Osama bin Laden's father came from Yemen, and Osama bin Laden still has many connections there.
Okay, and in terms of, so that seems to be the perspective of Yemen for Yemen. And what about the perspective for the U.S. and the West? As I said, we've been aligned ourselves with Saleh because of the presence of Al-Qaeda there and the fact that Yemen is sometimes called one of those failed or failing states, which everyone says are the birthplace or the breeding ground for terrorism. How do we play this one?
Well, the challenge for the United States now is to come up with a consistent approach to a lot of different countries. For 60 years, both Republican and Democratic administrations have given lip service to democracy and freedoms, but have done very little to enforce it. And now we are in the facing reality.
Yeah.
What's happening on the ground, and also trying to have a policy that applies to a place like Yemen as well as Egypt and Libya. That doesn't mean using force as we are in Libya in other places. Libya is unique in that regard. But we have to kind of think about the long term, which is something we've never been willing to do in the past. We've always opted for stability, even if that meant autocrats or inconsistency with our own values. And so now it's trying to help transitions to systems where people have that voice they so want in determining their future, that will encourage free elections, that will try to prevent, whether it's the military or new autocrats or extremist movements, from having a say in the future. And so it's really about talking about human rights and holding societies to a common standard, so that even in places like Saudi Arabia, where our instincts will probably be to support the monarchy because of the realities of oil and so forth, but to still say to them, you have to see the reality that's shaping your region now too, and you need to open up, whether it's on women's rights or voting rights. I mean, this is a country that doesn't have a parliament like some of its neighbors. So, again, Yemen is the most volatile of the societies, the place where we are the most vulnerable, and where we don't have a whole lot of good options. We have been primarily, as in other countries, investing in creating counterterrorism forces, not democratic forces. And so now we need to be probably a little bit more even-handed in looking at how do we help civil society groups, which are the, you know, grounds or the seeds for new political parties.
Right. Even if that doesn't get us that security of stability that we thought we had with the militant investment, and in fact investments in pro-democratic movements are in some sense investments in instability, in change.
Well, yes, all of these democratic transitions are going to lead to greater instability in the short term. In the long term, we hope for something different, but we have to be realistic. You know, I've covered, as you noted, a lot of places over my long career, and I covered the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the demise of the Soviet Union in 1991, but I also have traveled almost, you know, a generation later with the Secretary of State back to Moscow at a time that a former communist and KGB spy was in power. And in South Africa, I was there in 1976 when the first black mass uprising was launched. I went back in 1990 to watch Nelson Mandela walk to freedom. But a generation later, the majority of blacks actually live worse off economically than they did under apartheid. It's a sad truth that when Nelson Mandela walked to freedom, the average life expectancy was 60 years. Today, it's 41 years. There's 24% unemployment, and the current president is a man who is tried for rape. Transitions take a long time, and it's happened in our own countries. We fought a civil war over issues like including slavery, and how many decades? Virtually a century.
Virtually a century, before, exactly.
Before blacks actually got the vote. So, you know, it's not just over there that change takes a long time. I mean, I'm a woman, and I think how long did it take for women to get the vote in this country? And you know, there are five Muslim countries who've had female heads of states, and we haven't yet.
Irony there. That's the voice of Robin Wright, award-winning journalist and expert on the Middle East, and as you heard, on just an awful lot of foreign affairs and foreign policy. Her next book is Rock the Casbah. You can learn more at robinwright.net. Okay, let's move to Syria. I read this quote in the UK Guardian today. Regimes become really weak when their image turns to brutality. The killings in Daraa have done that, said Ziad Malki, an activist living in exile in Switzerland. The Syrian people want more now. The leadership today also announced they were lifting emergency law that's been in effect for nearly 50 years. Again, your assessment, your advice.
Well, Syria is a country that I think has surprised a lot of Mideast experts the most. The Assad family dynasty has been in power for four decades. And for a lot of diverse reasons, including its own brutality, the likelihood that dissidents, protesters, would be able to take to the streets was deemed quite difficult. I mean, I've been in Syria a number of times, and, you know, just driving down the street, you can be stuck in a taxi, you can be stopped and by a policeman who will make up some ridiculous charge, and what they really want is a bribe so that the to be paid off. Everything,
sure.
You know, everything has something to do with corruption or authoritarian rule. The secret police are everywhere, spying on each other as well as on the citizenry. And so it's a very difficult environment. Libya and Syria are in some way, and Saudi Arabia are probably the three most difficult places, very different systems to rise up. Well, Libya surprised us. Now Syria is surprising us. And, we have not reached the tipping point, Syria.
Right.
But the ability and the speed with which the protests have spread across the country is quite striking. And most recently, even in Latakia, which is a port city where the Assad family has its roots, to see dissent emerge, clashes with security forces and the deaths of the first protesters has been particularly striking.
I'd like to get just a little feel for each country in terms of the demographics and the economics. So Yemen, we said, very young, very poor. Syria, also very young, I assume, because almost every country there is. But what's the economic state of Syria?
Well, Syria is another country that is not an oil-rich country. It has, over the last decade, found some oil, and there are hopes that it will be able to export more as a source of income. It has engaged in some very modest economic reforms, but the reality is that the Assad family has controlled much of the profiteering. The Makhlouf family is notorious in Syria for having control over a lot of industries, whether it's the Dunkin' Donuts, which is on the border, or the cell phone franchise. And the Makhloufs are related through the president's mother-in-law. She was a Makhlouf. And so it's his cousins that control a lot of the businesses in Syria. And so while Syria's economy has developed a little bit, it is not distributing the wealth, the new wealth, widely to the people, and that's created a real problem. You also have ethnic divides. The regime is a minority, it's ruled by the Alawites, which is an offshoot of Shiite Islam. The majority of people in Syria are Sunni. And there's also a large Christian population and a significant Kurdish population. So there are a lot of things that kind of divide. And going back to your economic issue, the wealth doesn't always spread evenly, which helps foment the kind of internal divides within Syria.
Are there young moderns in urban centers in Syria as there are in Egypt, for instance?
Yes, I think in all these countries there are. And again, Facebook has been a way of getting the word out among the young about what started all of the protests, which in this case were a group of children who wrote some anti-regime graffiti on a wall in a town far from Damascus, along the border with Jordan. And that led to arrests and ignited protests, and off it's gone very quickly.
Wow. That's the voice of Robin Wright. Bahrain, where at least 20 people have been killed in a two-month uprising led by, again, a disaffected Shia majority against the Gulf Islands' Sunni rulers. Bahrain.
Yeah, Bahrain is a tricky issue because you do have that sectarian divide. But Bahrain, which is a very small island in the Persian Gulf, a fleck on the map, has become the kind of battleground between the two major powers in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia on one side and Iran on the other. Saudi Arabia has a long causeway to Bahrain and has often looked at Bahrain as its ally, but also a source of concern because of the large Shiite population. Iran, on the other side of the Gulf, is predominantly Shiite, and it has long territorial claims on the little island. It was part of the Persian Empire going back millennia, and it was only in 1970 when the Shah of Iran finally gave up Iran's claims as on the eve of its independence from British rule in 1971. So it's been very contemporary in terms of where are Bahrain's loyalties, where is the heart of the majority of its population. Now, it's not quite as simple as Sunni versus Shiite, because in Bahrain you have both Shiites who were Arabs and others who are Persian and have whose families come historically from Iran. So it's much more complicated. The tragedy of Little Bahrain is that the trouble probably could have been preempted if the young king had been willing to replace his prime minister, who'd been in power for 40 years, who'd also served the king's father. That was the real sticking point. Now it's reached such a stage because of the deaths of protesters, because of the use of force, because Saudi Arabia has now deployed its own troops in Bahrain, that people want more than that. And the future of the monarchy, or the form of the monarchy, is now an issue as well.
Okay. Yeah, it seems that a couple of themes I hear are these several cases of minority rule, and then the other thing, which is that, as that quote I quoted said, is that it's your response to the uprising that very often decides whether the uprising spreads and whether people begin demanding things they weren't demanding in the first place.
Well, that's correct. And I think that in each country, they're offering too little too late. And if they were willing to make the bold gestures, that it might preempt the scope of it. Some of the Gulf countries that have oil wealth have tried to buy out their populations. The king of Saudi Arabia, for example, came back after a three-month leave for medical treatment in the United States and recuperation in Morocco to offer a $36 billion program that would provide more jobs and more scholarships and a variety of perks. The question is, does it deal with the fundamental demands now among some quarters, not all quarters, for more women's rights, more active national participation in a political system, a greater structure, in other words, the introduction of a constitution and a parliament. Kuwait has done the same thing, trying to basically provide each family with over $3,000 in perks. And many of these countries have responded economically at a time that they're not all of them have the means to buy out or preempt or co-opt their own populations. And that's only gotten them deeper into debt at a time that they're also facing a global recession. And this long-term is not the solution. It will create greater instability economically in some of these countries. So the finding the right balance is always the trick, and there's not a single one of them yet that's found a good balance.
That's right. That's right. Anything more about Saudi Arabia? I mean, it seems to me, on the one hand, you announce $36 billion in jobs and housing and so on, and at the same time, you send troops to quell protests in Bahrain. It seems a bit schizophrenic, and yet that, as you say, is one of the countries that has no parliament, that has made the littlest progress or very little progress toward being anything but the family's country. And it's the one, the richest, I believe, and it's the one that we support and depend on the most. What do people think is going to happen in Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's actually not the richest. It has a significant problem with unemployment, which is about at least 10%. And it's because its demographics have exploded, it is having a very hard time dealing with its young population. I believe Qatar is the richest country. It has a very small population, a lot of oil and gas. And, you know, remember, Saudi Arabia is a country where women cannot even drive yet. So we're talking about rights that are among the most basic. A woman is not supposed to, you know, play an active role, visible role in society where there are a lot of men. You know, women can become doctors and lawyers, but they deal largely with their own gender. And just even the king, who's a comparative reformer, has introduced a university where they have co-ed classes, and this was quite controversial. The problem in the Gulf, particularly Saudi Arabia, but also in other countries, is you have a very conservative clergy.
Right.
And the relationship between the tribal ruling families and the clergy has provided legitimacy for each one of them. Together, they have so far managed to bring societies along. But that delicate balance has also made it very difficult to move into a 21st century world. And so just renegotiating the relationship that has been the foundation of some of these states is going to be really pivotal to the outcomes. We're talking about a lot more than simply introducing a parliament. It goes to the real kind of existential issues, the origins of the states.
Right. In other words, you're saying you've got conservative clergy who have been supportive of autocratic rule, and both of them, in a way, supporting each other, letting each other stay behind the times. The times are catching up with them.
The times are catching up with both of them. In Saudi Arabia, for example, you have the House of Saud as the ruling family, and you have the Wahhabi clerics. The Wahhabi clerics are the most conservative branch of Islam, and this is the branch from which Osama bin Laden came. And they have very rigid views about living the values of the time Islam was founded in the 7th century. Now, that doesn't mean they're against television and cars and kind of the modern equipment, but it does mean that they want the purity of values. And that makes it very difficult for the royal family to introduce major reforms. And the royal family itself is divided among generations, and even among the 43 sons of the founding king, Ibn Saud, you have a wide variety of opinions. The current king is a relative, and I emphasize relative, reformer, whereas some of his brothers, also elderly in their 70s and 80s, who may succeed him, are much more conservative.
Tunisia, where all of this started in late 2010, we don't hear about it much right now. What has happened?
Well, Tunisia is in that awkward stage of waiting for new elections, trying to figure out what political forces are available. I think the short term, we're likely to see three blocks of power emerge. One will be the remains of the old ruling parties in some places like Tunisia, where they've been outlawed, but they still have connections, they still have the organizational skills, and they still have an agenda. And so it will be dregs of the party that emerge. Then you have the weak civil society, the youth groups that inspired and led the uprising and that ousted President Ben Ali. But they don't have experience. They don't have a lot of time. They have almost no resources, unlike the old ruling party.
Mm-hmm.
And so for them quickly to create, you know, a party with a platform, get out there and campaign, know how to do this, is going to be very difficult. And then you have in each society, you know, some kind of Islamic party. That doesn't necessarily mean they're extremists. In Tunisia, you have one of the most modest, which has said it will not run a candidate for president. It's an offshoot of the old Muslim Brotherhood, but it is moderated among quite significantly over the years. There are still fears that, you know, an Islamic party will emerge. But I think one of the things we have discovered across the region is that these uprisings signal two things. One is the rejection of violence and extremism, whether it's Osama bin Laden or Islamic Jihad or any of the extremist groups that have not provided tangible answers to the challenges of daily life, be it jobs or education, healthcare, or even good garbage collection.
Mm-hmm.
Al-Qaeda proved in a kind of dynamic way that it could challenge regimes and challenge the West, but nothing after that. And it's really faded from the national debate virtually everywhere, except where old leaders like Muammar Gaddafi are trying to invoke it as, you know,
right.
The danger.
Right.
And the second thing is the rejection of Islamist theology. The Iranian model, which was so dramatic in 1979, is just not an alternative today. People are talking about democracy, not theology. Now, these are all conservative societies, and Islam will probably become important in shaping values, in being a pillar for people to hang on to during the tornadoes of political transition. But that doesn't mean they want Islamic states or that they want Islamic rule or theocratic rule. But will Islamic parties get votes? Absolutely. The Muslim Brotherhood under Mubarak got about 20% of the vote, and it will do at least that well, probably in new elections. But it will be the third force in all of these countries. And the balance will be slightly different in each one. But that's what we are likely to see, I think, in elections that play out over the next year.
Yeah, one of the things you pointed to was in speaking about Tunisia, but I assume something similar is somewhat true about all of them, is that the democracy movements in their adhocratic nature, that is, uprisings that sort of spontaneous seem to emerge, lack infrastructure and experience and so on. One of the things that I know we've talked about in the past, Robin, was that when autocrats rule politics in these nations, mosques became one of the few outlets where folks could congregate, could develop even social systems and so on. And so it makes sense that if the autocrat is either overthrown or even weakened, that the mosques are one of the places where there's at least some incipient experience.
But that's true in all societies. Religion is an idiom of opposition and an idiom of transition when there's no other alternatives. That's been true of the church, the synagogue, the temple, and the mosque. When you think about the roots of this country, why did people come to America? It was to escape persecution. It was because they wanted religious freedom.
Or even looking at the American Civil Rights Movement.
Well, sure. And you look today at the Dalai Lama, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for leading a campaign against China's rule of Tibet. Whether you look at Desmond Tutu in South Africa, who the Archbishop of Cape Town, who became very active when Nelson Mandela was in prison because there was no other vehicle. You look at liberation theology in Latin America during the era of military dictatorships, the Jewish refuseniks in the Soviet Union, the Protestant-based communities in Eastern Europe, that religion has been very important in providing values, in providing a venue for people to meet, to discuss rights, to look for alternatives. But that doesn't mean, I mean, we'll look at Poland, the role of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And again, in the Philippines, in confronting Ferdinand Marcos, where a cardinal, Jaime Sin, used Vatican Radio in the Philippines as a voice for the opposition against Ferdinand Marcos. That this has been true in many societies when there's no alternative. But that doesn't mean that you have a Christian theocracy in Poland or the Philippines, that that people use it as part of the transition, but not the long term. This is where we're finding in the 21st century, you have certain kind of global standards. Now, everyone is going to have strong cultural ties, strong religion. I mean, you look at the United States, and religion is still a very strong force in shaping political values in the 21st century. That will be true of Islam in Muslim societies as well.
Yeah, and I wasn't suggesting that was a threat or a boogeyman. I was merely suggesting, as you've just enlarged upon, the reality of when activity is suppressed except religion. Religion is where people meet, congregate, and develop networks, and so on.
Yes, exactly.
Let me move to Egypt. More than 77% of the estimated 14 million people who voted recently supported changes that will provide a blueprint for parliamentary and presidential elections to be held within the next 6 months. How are things unfolding in Egypt? Who's in charge?
Not smoothly. It's very interesting. You know, the diversity of opinion creates rivalries, and it's very interesting to see what's happened among the young people who were united in their opposition to Mubarak's rule, but now there are a lot of splits emerging as they go in different political directions. There have been differences as well among generations about how fast do you move toward elections. The young people actually wanted more time so that they could organize political parties. They were opposed to these amendments because they wanted to force the rewriting of the Constitution, not just amending it. It's not good for women as well. So there were forces that said, hey, let's slow down a little bit, let's create more time. But there were many from the old regime that wanted to, because they're still organized, to see elections as soon as possible. There were some from the Muslim Brotherhood, the largest opposition organization, who felt they were ready for elections. So, again, this is a very delicate process that's playing out, and not everyone's going to be happy. And the interesting thing is the protests didn't end with Hosni Mubarak's ouster. You continue to see small protests, whether it's in front of the parliament, in front of state-controlled television, in front of business offices, even in front of department stores, as people demand more wages, more jobs, that the issues become smaller. And now that they've found their voice, boy, do they want to use it.
And sadly, it's the suppression of protest didn't end with Mubarak's demise either.
That's right. And one of the moves that's not passed yet is a measure that might outlaw some of these protests, make people liable for heavy fines or charges against them if they become disruptive. Well, then you get into the business of what is disruptive.
And who disrupts.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, think of Chicago 68. What about Iran? I mean, it's funny that Iran, who probably has been the most focused on and most talked about, you know, in some circles for the last few years, comes up this late in our conversation. Their green revolution had its ups and downs. And despite 6 months of political turmoil after the disputed 2009 presidential election, they never seem to approach that kind of critical mass that took down Mubarak. What's the situation there? And I know, let me just tell people, by the way, you have another book coming out soon where you have a key contribution in the Iran Primer, Power, Politics, and U.S. Policy. When does that come out?
Oh, that's out.
Oh, it's out. Okay. So that's...
The whole book is free on iranprimer.com.
Great.
And it's updated every 2 days with new chapters. It brought together 50 authors. I'm the editor, and we try to look at all the different aspects of Iran. But Iran's an interesting place because one of the key issues in these upheavals is momentum. And the people had the momentum, as you noted, for 6 months. But the regime then decided that it would militarize in order to survive. And it put down relentlessly all the different kinds of public displays, as well as the silent civil disobedience, the kinds of things that involved economic boycotts and graffiti on the national currency condemning the regime and so forth. The interesting thing is I had young friends in Egypt who were quite inspired by what happened in Iran and understood that people power, when millions took to the street, could make a difference, and used that as a new model. And then after Egypt and the ouster of Hosni Mubarak, Iranians tried again. They didn't get very far.
Right.
There was a battering of new protests. But the Iran story is far from over, and it is as vulnerable as any other government. It will not play out as quickly. It has much more experience. It has one of the largest militaries and security forces in the world, and a network of volunteers who they give perks to, whether it's guaranteeing a place in a university or a little bit extra income that they can call on in neighborhoods to go after people, to spy on them, and so forth. They've had Stalin-esque show trials, the gross human rights violations used against some of the dissidents have drawn the attention of the United Nations, which just last week appointed a new investigator of human rights violations in Iran. So the three trends I think you're seeing in the region are the Arab revolts in the 22 Arab countries. You're seeing the emergence of a counter-jihad, the rejection of extremist violence and extremist parties like bin Laden and others. But third, the rejection of Islamic theology. And all of these blend together. They're going to play out in different ways, at different speeds. I mean, when you look at what happened in 1989, it played out between February and November in Eastern Europe, and you're talking about, you know, a block of countries that spans two continents and an awful lot of different types of societies and political systems, unlike Eastern Europe, where it was basically one type of system with one, you know, puppeteer in Moscow. That's very different from what we're seeing in the Middle East right now.
Just to jump into one thing you mentioned there about how the transitions play out and so on, it seems to me revolutions often follow a two-stage process, at least. There's a people's uprising that overthrows a despot. Then as things sort themselves out over the next several months, new leadership emerges or takes over, you know, Russia in 1917, Iran in 1979. What's your take on the likelihood of that sort of thing in these uprisings, and how do you prepare for that? How does the U.S. or the U.N. kind of deal with that?
Well, the danger after revolutions is that new autocrats simply replace old autocrats. That was true of the French Revolution, the Soviet Revolution, and the Iranian Revolution, which were the three revolutions that redefine the political spectrum in introducing democracy, communism, and Islam as political forces. And so that's a real danger, you know. And this is where U.S. policy has to, again, focus on a common standard. What is it that is acceptable. And the world has spoken with a common voice when it comes to a place like Libya, where it's fairly easy. It's going to be tougher when it comes to a place like Saudi Arabia, when the world is still dependent on oil and will be until it explores alternative energy sources and ends its, you know, dependence on states that have some of the worst human rights standards in the world.
Okay, that leads me to another thought. Domestically, it appears to me that the Obama administration has demonstrated, perhaps even more clearly than the Bush White House, just how beholden Washington is to corporate funders. We find that even with a Democrat who talked a progressive game in the 08 campaign, it's become ever clearer that big corporations very often are calling the shots, if not about the final outcome, about how far you'll go, leading Democrats, I feel, repeatedly to negotiate with themselves because their funders want one thing and their constituents might want another. How do you see that sort of influence playing out in foreign policy in the Middle East, for example, as you just sort of kind of referred?
You're going into territory in which I have no expertise. I know nothing about corporate involvement. I'm not a great specialist on domestic politics. But it is true that one of the challenges for the United States is how to balance our basic economic needs against our longstanding political values. And we're increasingly going into some very tough territory in which the two clash quite dramatically. You have the price of oil at over $100 a barrel at a time we're pushing the regimes that have that oil to change. And, you know, we don't have the kind of leverage because of our dependence on oil that we have elsewhere in the world.
Yeah. That's the voice of Robin Wright, editor of the Iran Primer, Power Politics and U.S. Policy, which is available, as you said, free download at iranprimer.com.
Yes.
Yeah, at iranprimer.com, and updated, as she says, every 2 days by a group of 50 experts from around the globe, and also a book coming out later this year, Rock the Casbah. Libya. When Gaddafi threatened a bloodbath, I was not surprised. It would be nice if every country followed the example of the Eastern European uprisings of the late 80s or of Tunisia and Egypt. But sooner or later, I think we had to assume that one of these, quote, ruthless dictators was going to act like a ruthless dictator. If you were advising Obama or the UN or NATO or whoever the body is that seems to be intervening, what would your advice have been and what would it be now?
Libya is a challenge for a number of reasons that have to do with the kind of pattern of change in the region, even more than with Libya itself. This is a large geographic mass, but a very small population. It's about the size of Alaska, but only has 6.5 million people, smaller than New York City. It has a lot of oil on which the Europeans are dependent. But what happened after Tunisia and Egypt was quite exhilarating in seeing peaceful civil disobedience. I'm sure Osama bin Laden, off in his hiding place, was green with envy that a campaign that he and his lieutenants had waged for more than a decade, for almost two decades, against autocratic regimes had gone no place, and they were off hidden, whereas young people with no resources had mobilized opposition, and in the case of 1 month in Tunisia, ousted a man who'd been in power for 23 years. And in Egypt, ousted a man in 18 days who had been in power for three decades. And Libya suddenly represented a deviation from the pattern. As Gaddafi used brute force in putting down the rebellion in his own country, there was suddenly a sense in the region that, oh, well, maybe that's all it takes, just greater brutality than the Egyptians or Tunisians used, and we can stem the tide. And so the stakes in Libya suddenly became much bigger. Now, Libya is an aberration because Colonel Gaddafi, whom I've interviewed, is also deeply eccentric. There are legitimate questions about his medical state. And
you mean mental state?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can, you know, tell you from firsthand experience. And there and so he was not beloved by any of the leaders, either in the two worlds he straddles, Africa or the Arab bloc. And so no one really was going to come to his aid and make a case on his behalf anywhere in the world. And so the use of force by NATO, the United States, and this coalition that involves some Arab members as well is more viable in Libya. I don't think there's any other country in the region where that would be acceptable, where it wouldn't meet deep resistance. I also think that Libya was at a stage where Benghazi, the second city where the rebellion is headquartered and where it started, was probably about to be lost within 24 or 48 hours. It was that close a call. I think that's why the speed of a speedy decision was made to intervene. I mean, no place else have you seen, you think of the Gulf War and how long that played out in 1990 and 1991 when Iraq invaded Kuwait, that a lot of these cases take a long time to mobilize international approval, a UN vote, and a coalition that will act. This is one that played out uniquely. Libya is a place where Gaddafi could fight on for a while. I think it will depend on what those closest to him in the military, but particularly his family, ultimately do to try to save themselves. I do not see him coming out of this as leader of the country. I would be surprised if he's still there at the end of the year, whether he seeks refuge elsewhere or, takes the final bullet, is unclear, and I think trying to predict it is too difficult.
And so, in other words, because of what you said at the top about his fairly unique place, and I wondered whether Saddam Hussein might have been in a similar sort of category, that the blowback from or the negative repercussions of a Western intervention there are not as great as one might fear.
At this stage, they're not as great as one might fear. Saddam Hussein still had his Arab backers. Remember, Yasser Arafat came to his aid. There were those some in the Gulf who, like the Emir of Qatar, who tried to, negotiate. He was increasingly isolated, but he could still smuggle to the outside world. He still did business. He had, it was a very different kind of society, much larger, much greater strategic position.
Yeah.
Muammar Gaddafi doesn't have any of those advantages, and he controls a rump state where he's, he's losing his military, which is actually very small. Saddam Hussein had a very large military. Gaddafi has also divided his military in order not to face an internal threat, and his sons control various factions, but he's created rivalries within the military in order not to make sure that it was never strong enough to challenge his own rule.
Very good. I just the one area that we're not going to have time to talk about, although I can give you 30 seconds if you want to say anything, is Israel-Palestine. It seems like that was, events have been going on surrounding it, and then suddenly starting, March 11th with the stabbing, we see a new tit-for-tat escalation between, in that area.
In all of the revolts so far, the issues have been domestic. They have not focused on either Israel or the United States. This has been about domestic politics. What happened in Israel is another tragedy, but it reflects the internal tensions. But there are also a lot of Palestinians who are watching what's happening elsewhere in the Arab world and saying, what about us?
Yeah, what about us vis-a-vis Israel or vis-a-vis Palestine, right?
What about us in our own country?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, that's a whole other conversation. I'm going to have to let it go. What I would like to do, however, is read one last quote from you from that Washington Post op-ed 3 years ago. You wrote, not all of the Middle East new actors will succeed. For all the signs of promise, the region is still full of shadows. Democracy is about differences, which are bound to explode once disparate sides of society are free to speak and make demands. Opening new space does not guarantee who or what will fill it, and all the factors contributing to change make the region susceptible to greater turmoil. Yet what I found most inspiring in my travels was not the dreams that the outside world has set for the people of the Middle East. It was the lofty goals they have set for themselves and only begun in March 2008 to act on. So that's about the time we have. The IranPrimer.com is where you can check out frequent updates to this big project, bringing experts from around the globe to comment on Iran. Robin Wright is the editor of that, IranPrimer.com. You can download the entire book as well as the updates. Her next book will be Rock the Casbah, How Street Vendors, Sheiks, Rappers, and Women Are Shattering the Old Order. And you can learn more about her work at RobinWright.net. Thank you to Robin Wright. I really appreciate the amount of information and wisdom that we were able to put out today. Keep up the good work.